Tonight's speaker is Brother Ron Cowie from the Golden Grove, Australia Ecclesia. The theme for Brother Cowie's classes this week is Jeremiah and the Remnant. The title of tonight's class is Jeremiah, Man of Contentions. Brother Cowie.
Thanks, Brother Chairman, and good evening, brethren and sisters. We have given out to you a handout, which some of you may already have, on which is a chronology of the book of Jeremiah. And what it does is to thread together, as best we've been able to do so far, the life of Jeremiah, the incidents in his life, the things happening to him and his friends, along with the history of the various kings and the nations around the nation of Israel that had a great bearing on the book of Jeremiah. Perhaps the most important part of that chronology we've given you is the putting of the chapters of Jeremiah into a suggested order in which they actually were given and should be read. Interesting contemplation to think why it was that when this book was recorded by the Spirit that the chapters are so much out of order. And I'd love to hear anyone that's got a suggestion or theory on that particular point. But it is very helpful to read the book of Jeremiah chronologically. And that's what we've tried to do in that chapter, in that chronology, and also to give you some idea of what's happening around the place, particularly amongst the other nations, which have a bearing upon those prophecies. What we're going to do in these three sessions is to look at tonight Jeremiah himself, and particularly his struggle with God. Then we're going to look at a couple of his companions in the next two sections, the Rechabites and Ebed-Melech. Our authority for looking at Jeremiah we take from the fifth chapter of James, where James said, "Take, my brethren, the prophets, who have spoken in the name of the Lord for an example of suffering affliction and of patience." And that was the universal experience of the prophets, that they suffered affliction and patience. "Behold, we count them happy which endure." You've heard of the patience of Job. And I want you to just notice that in the very same verse that he's talking about prophets, he mentions the patience of Job. And we're going to see how much Jeremiah found identification with Job. You've heard of the patience of Job and have seen the end of the Lord. And we know the end of the Lord concerning Job, how that God blessed Job more than he ever had before. But the end of the Lord also applies to Jeremiah. And we're going to see that tonight, what God had in store for Jeremiah. The Lord is very pitiful and of tender mercy. So we're going to take the greatest of the prophets for an example of suffering, affliction and of patience. Now the book of Jeremiah is the largest book in the Bible in quantity of verses. If we accept that the Psalms is a collation of many writers, the book of Jeremiah is the largest number of verses written by any one writer in the Bible. Then we add to that the book of Lamentations, which are Jeremiah's personal insights upon the tragedy of the destruction of Jerusalem. And by that means, we happen to know more about Jeremiah than any other of the prophets. It was a truly incredible life. It was a 40-year ministry at least, perhaps more. It was against huge odds and amongst great sufferings and enormous disappointments, the greatest of which was no doubt the loss of Josiah, his faithful friend and companion in trying to redeem the nation for God. To that was added the loss of his Sunday school class into captivity as the good figs that would go away to Babylon, a class containing men like Daniel and his friends, Mordecai, Ezra, Zephaniah, Habakkuk, a lot of those people that had been proteges of Jeremiah and Josiah were dispersed by the captivity that came upon them. And Jeremiah was called by God at a very young age to take on apathy, to take on the idolatry and the violent opposition of those in the nation who wanted the status quo to remain. And he was required by God to courageously speak out against them and to condemn everybody for the state of the nation. It was for him personally a time of great sadness and depression, and even moments of resentment against God because of what came upon him. And we're going to look through those times tonight where he had discussions with God about his lot, having to be the prophet of doom for the nation. We're going to look at those times when he was betrayed by family and friends, when he was persecuted by his hometown, resisted by wicked kings. When he was called a traitor, a warmonger, a schemer, a fool, a false prophet. When he was imprisoned and beaten and put in the stocks. He went through all kinds of turmoil, his motives questioned. He was called a deserter to the enemy. And in the middle of all that controversy that he had to go through, he clung to his God and to God's promises. And there really is no more courageous Stoic than when we see Jeremiah sitting amidst the ruins and the dust and the ashes of the city of Jerusalem. His friends and his supporters having been taken away by the Babylonians. The throne of David completely overthrown and toppled, and the king taken off to be put to death in Babylon. It is of Yahweh's mercies, he said, that we are not consumed. You know, we love these words because they are such great sentiments. But you think when they were written, he was sitting in the ruins of Jerusalem. It is of Yahweh's mercies we are not consumed, because his compassions fail not. They are new every morning. Great is thy faithfulness. Yahweh is my portion, says my soul. Therefore I hope in him. Yahweh is good unto them that wait for him. To the soul that seeks him, it's good that a man should both hope and quietly wait for the salvation of God. And the mature Jeremiah has come to that conviction. But things didn't get any better. Within a few days of writing those words, his faithful friend, Gedaliah, was murdered. And Jeremiah was dragged off to die as an exile in Egypt. And the people still rejecting his words. But you see, there's the personal inward conviction of the man. It is of Yahweh's mercies we are not consumed. And the fact that he survived against all the attempts to take his life for over 40 years and to die of old age in Egypt is testament to the fact that God was merciful to preserve Jeremiah. He said to him on a number of occasions and to his friends, I will give thee thy life for a prey. And the Hebraism that goes behind that of giving thee thy life for a prey, which was said to Barak and to Ebed-Melech and to others, it's like a little antelope. You've probably seen the Reader's Digest films where the antelope is running across the prairie or across the African plains, and the lion or the cheetah is gaining on it. And the little antelope is ducking this way and jumping sideways. And at one stage, the lion will knock it off its feet and it will roll through the dust and get up running and eventually escape into the bush. And that's the Hebraism. I'll give you your life for a prey. You'll be rescued from the jaws of the lion. And that's what happened to Jeremiah. It is of Yahweh's mercies that we are not consumed. And he lived a life of inspiration. But more than that, even though he regretted so much that he could not convert the nation, that all his appeals went unheeded, God had to remind Jeremiah that it wasn't the fact that he would save the nation. He was there to witness against the nation. It was too late, Jeremiah, to save the nation. Don't even bother to pray to them. Pray to me for them. It's too late, Jeremiah, to save the nation. The end is decreed and it will come certainly. What you've got to do, Jeremiah, is to save the remnant. God said to Jeremiah, when he was in the midst of complaining, he said, Jeremiah, it will be well with thee, with the remnant, with thy remnant. Verily I will cause the enemy to entreat thee well in the time of evil and in the time of affliction. And so God promised that he would deliver Jeremiah's remnant. Some of them were delivered to Babylon that they might there lay the foundations of the revival of the fortunes of Israel, like Daniel and those that would follow his example. Like Ezra that would come back. But it was only a remnant that he would save. And God said to Jeremiah, Jeremiah, inspire a few. And he didn't realize that down through the centuries he would inspire many who would look at his example and his suffering and his patience. Why was it that God called men like Jeremiah to be prophets? What was God trying to do? If he had decreed that Jerusalem and the nation was finished, why did God send prophets to them? Well, it was that the remnant might respond. and so that nobody could say that God had not warned them. I have spoken by the prophets, I have multiplied visions and used similitudes by the ministry of the prophets. And the word ministry in the Hebrew is the Hebrew word yad, which is hand. The hand or the service of the prophets is the way that God speaks. He is the great mind, the prophets are the hand and the voice of God. Surely God will do nothing, but he revealeth his secret unto his servants, the prophets. The lion has roared, who will not fear? If you're in the jungle at night and you hear the roar of a lion, you respond. The adrenaline starts pumping. So do the legs, probably. But God asked the question. The Lord God has spoken. Who can but prophesy? What prophet, having hearing the judgments of God, can do anything but speak? For the watchman must blow the trumpet. And God loves his prophets. It's quite amazing when you go to the last book of the Bible, just how much is said about God's future reward for the prophets. They were a very special class of people, were the prophets. Unpopular always. Persecuted many, many times. Knowing the loneliness of rejection on most occasions. And God says the time will come, the time of the dead, and he would reward his servants, the prophets. You see the particular mention they get. He didn't in that passage necessarily say that he would reward the great men of the Old Testament. He said he would reward the prophets. That's what's dominating God's mind. To them that fear thy name, small and great. And in the destruction of the apostasy, he says, rejoice over her, thou heaven, and ye holy apostles and prophets. And the persecution of the prophets by the system of Jezebel goes right back to the days of Elijah. When the woman Jezebel killed the prophets of Yahweh. And in her was found the blood of the prophets and of saints, says God. So you see, God has a great love and a great reward for his prophets who suffered. I want you to come to Hebrews chapter 11. It always amazes us, doesn't it, when we look at the great people that make the list of witnesses in Hebrews 11 about the ones that don't appear to be there. And we know why that was, because time failed Paul to include everybody that could have been put in the list of faithful witnesses in this list. But Paul didn't forget the prophets either. He said at the end of verse 32, what could I more say? Time would fail me to tell of Gideon and Barak and Samson and Jephthah and David and Samuel and of the prophets. He was not unmindful that the prophets really would have been in this list had it been completed. But he didn't forget Jeremiah. You come over the page to verse 36. Every word in Hebrews 11, verse 36, every single word is applicable to Jeremiah and to very few of the other prophets. And others had trial of cruel mockings. That's Jeremiah. I am in derision daily, he said in Jeremiah 20. And scourgings. Pasha had him scourged and put in the stocks. Moreover, of bonds and imprisonment. And he spent years of his life either in prison cells or in the court of the prison. Every word in verse 36 applies to Jeremiah. That's his verse in Hebrews 11. And others, he said in verse 37, were stoned. And others were sawn asunder, like Isaiah reputedly was. But verse 36 is Jeremiah to a T. And Jeremiah's life was not only sufferings, but it was sacrifice as well. Look what God asked Jeremiah to do, that he might be an example to the nation. Look at the personal sacrifice that was involved in the mission that he was given to do. Thou shalt not take thee a wife. That would have been, perhaps for Jeremiah, a great trial with life. Imagine going through life, the sort of life he had to put up, with no one to confide in personally. Should have neither sons nor daughters in this place. No one to declare his generation. But if that wasn't bad enough, no social life either. Jeremiah, go not to the house of mourning. You can't even mourn with your friends. Neither to lament or bemoan them. He had to appear to everybody to be totally unrelated to the social life of the nation. Can't even go to the house of feasting to eat and to drink. No pleasures of life whatsoever, Jeremiah. You've got to be a walking testimony to the fact that judgment is about to fall and that nothing else matters. And Jeremiah never understood when he started just how much was involved. Look at Jeremiah chapter 1 and verse 19. He had no idea what was ahead of him when he began this 40-year journey. Jeremiah chapter 1 and verse 18. Behold, I've made thee this day a defence city and an iron pillar and a brazen wall against the whole land. You've got to be tough, Jeremiah. You've got to be like iron and brass. A defence city. They're going to come and attack you. Against the kings of Judah, the princes thereof, the priests thereof, and the people, and the false prophets. And everybody's going to be against you, Jeremiah. And they shall fight against thee. But they shall not prevail against thee, for I am with thee. And the same thing's there in verse 8. Be not afraid of their faces, for I am with thee, to deliver thee, saith Yahweh. Now, if you were given that promise, you would think, well, I can put up with this for a short time, because God is with me. He had no idea it would be 40 years, nor would it be as bad as it was. He never foresaw the great struggle that was coming. And I guess most of us, when we start out and respond to the calling of God, have no idea of the valleys and the shadows that God will take us through in our life journey. Jeremiah had tremendous struggles with his God. You see, he started out quite optimistic, as I guess everybody would, that you might actually have a great impact on the nation. Barak had the same problem. They thought they could change things. But it didn't work like that. And after a while, Jeremiah found him not only doubting God, he found doubting himself. And as one writer very brilliantly put it, no prophet of God was at once more sure of his words, but less sure of himself. And Jeremiah went through stages in life where he said, cursed is the day that I was born. It was a great mistake I came into this world. And he wanted to give up more than once. And the reason was, he gave up so much that he might save the nation, and it didn't achieve anything. Give heed to me, O Yahweh, and hearken to the voice of them that contend with me. Can't you hear what they're saying, God? Shall evil be recompensed for good? They've digged a pit for my soul. And all I wanted to do was to speak thy words to them, God, and to turn away thy wrath from them. That was his motivation. And he complained to God that God wasn't listening to what they were saying. You see, he had no idea of the time frames when he started out. It was a 40-year ministry by the time that Jerusalem fell. But the hard part for Jeremiah was the first 23 years. Not because he had 18 years with Josiah, which was wonderful. But the problem he had with the rest of the people was that for the first 23 years, not one single prophecy came to pass. Now you imagine walking around a nation for 23 years crying doom and gloom and captivity and overthrow to the point that people hate you so much they thrash you and put you in the stocks, they spit in your face and call you names and deride you every day, and you go on for 23 years making those prophecies and nothing happens. How would you feel? And he went to God and he said, you've deceived me. You see, that was the hard part, was the length that he had to go. The fierce opposition from priests and prophets and kings and the misunderstanding of his motives, that was the hard part. And the fact that nobody really changed except the very, very few. You see, God had said that the nation was finished. And because of the sins of Manasseh, I will cause them to be removed, said God, for that which he did in Jerusalem. He said to Jeremiah, look, Jeremiah, don't pray to me. You keep coming to me saying, please God, save the nation. Please God, repent. He said, Jeremiah, don't pray. It's a waste of time. They are finished. The nation will go. And why would the nation be so doomed? Why would God not repent? Well, the sins of Manasseh were irreversible on that nation. Not on individuals. There were always a few who would respond. But as far as the nation was concerned, it was irreversible. You know what Manasseh had done? The greatest sin of Manasseh was that he hid the ecclesia from the Bible for over 50 years. How would you survive if there'd been no Bible classes for probably 55 years? No exhortations, no tapes, no books, no Bibles. You think you'd survive? Manasseh had taken the spiritual heart out of the nation and replaced it with idols in the house of God, burning children in Gehenna, worshipping the host of heaven, bringing in every strange religion and doctrine he could find. And though Manasseh repented at the end of his life, the damage was irreversible. And God said, because of the sins of Manasseh, they will go into captivity. No way out, Jeremiah. Don't even pray for them. Here's what he was up against. Total apathy. Turned under God faintedly. Refusing to hearken. Loving to hear the voice of the false prophet saying, peace, peace, when there was nothing but judgment coming. And the prophets getting up and saying great, wonderful speeches about the fact that God would bring peace upon his chosen nation. And here's poor old Jeremiah saying, you're going to go to Babylon. It's all going to go. The great thing that Jeremiah had to contend with in Israel was that they believed they were the chosen people of God. They believed there was no possible way that the God of Israel, who had chosen them above all the other nations, would not have a throne in Jerusalem, that he would not have his own chosen people. They believed that they were the elite and all the rest were dogs. And it's not possible, therefore, that God would ultimately destroy his nation. They had a tremendous sense of nationalism. They just could not accept what Jeremiah was saying. Yes, we might have made a few mistakes, but in the end, God will save his temple and his king. But God had said, for the sins of Judah, they would go into captivity. He said to Jeremiah, you get down to the temple, Jeremiah. You stand at the gate of the temple. When they go up to keep their feast in the temple, and you tell them what I want you to tell them. You tell them, Jeremiah, this place is a den of thieves. Jesus quoted those words later on. You tell them, Jeremiah, that this house that you come to worship in is going to become like Shiloh. Even in the days of Jeremiah, nobody could really find where Shiloh was. The house of Eli was so totally obliterated, there was nothing left. And today you can go to the land and ask to be taken to Shiloh, and you'll have to get a very good guide to take you where it used to be. There's nothing there. And God said to Jeremiah, you tell them that this house will become like Shiloh, like the house of Eli. And you tell them the city's going to be destroyed and burnt with fire. And you're all going to go to Babylon into captivity. You tell them that, Jeremiah. Can you imagine how popular that was in a city and a nation that was full of nationalistic spirit? No wonder he got a reaction. Now, what we want to do from here on is just to go through and to look at Jeremiah debating with God how he felt about the opposition. Let's start in chapter 9 and verse 4 to 6. I'm going to run through these fairly quickly because these are all the times that Jeremiah and God have a discussion about his expectations and what's not happening and what God says to him. Now, Jeremiah chapter 9 and verse 4, circumcise to Yahweh and take away the foreskins of your heart, ye men of Judah and the inhabitants of Jerusalem, lest my fury come forth like... Sorry, I'm reading Jeremiah 4. Jeremiah 9 and verse 4. Now, this is the words of God to Jeremiah. I read from the NIV. Beware of your friends. Do not trust your brothers, for every brother is a deceiver. Verse 6. You live in the midst of deception. And you see, God is warning Jeremiah. Look, Jeremiah, your problem is that you think you can trust people. You don't trust your friends. Don't even trust your brothers. Jeremiah, because you're living in the midst of deception. Come to chapter 11 and verse 18. See the sort of problem he had to contend with. Jeremiah 11 and verse 18. Yahweh hath given me knowledge, and I know it. Then thou showest me their doings. I was brought like a lamb or an ox that is brought to the slaughter. There's one of the identifications as a type of Christ. I knew not they had devised devices against me. And Jeremiah is saying to God, look, I've just woken up to the fact that everybody's plotting against me. And I'm saying, let us destroy the tree with the fruit thereof. Let us cut him off from the land of the living, that his name may be no more remembered. And you see, what the men of Jerusalem had done, what the prophets and the priests had done, is they'd gone to Jeremiah's hometown, Anathoth. And they said to the men of Anathoth, you've got a troublemaker in your midst. You sort him out for us. And God's reply is in verse 21. Therefore thus saith Yahweh of the men of Anathoth that seek thy life, saying, prophesy not in the name of Yahweh. That's what they wanted Jeremiah to do. Stop prophesying, that thou die not by our hand. They'd threatened him with death if he kept prophesying. God says to the men of Anathoth, I will punish them in verse 21. The young men shall die by the sword, their sons and their daughters shall die by famine, and there shall be no remnant of them. And God had said to Jeremiah in chapter 17, verse 11, I will save your remnant. But there'll be no remnant of them, Jeremiah, in Anathoth, your hometown. For I will bring evil upon the men of Anathoth, even the year of their visitation. And when the Babylonians came against Jerusalem for the last time, there was only Jeremiah left to buy his uncle's inheritance in Anathoth. The rest of them, as God had predicted, were no longer there. So you see, his hometown had conspired against him, just like the men of Nazareth did with Christ. They sought to silence the word of God. A prophet is not without honour, says the Bible, except in his own country. Chapter 12 and verse 1. And here's Jeremiah beginning to now to really complain to God about his treatment. Jeremiah 12 verse 1. Righteous art thou, O Yahweh, when I plead with thee. Let me talk. Look at the margin. You've got a margin. Let me reason of the case with thee. He's starting now to really debate with God about what's happening. Let me reason the case with you, God, about my treatment. Wherefore does the way of the wicked prosper? Why are they happy that deal treacherously? They've taken root, they grow, they bring forth fruit. He says in verse 3, but thou, O Yahweh, knowest me. Thou hast seen me and tried my heart toward thee. God, why don't you judge them? Why don't you bring something upon them? I'm prophesying and prophesying and nothing happens. And he's starting to question God. And the reply of God in verse 5, brethren and sisters, is quite astounding. It's so different to the way we would handle somebody who was complaining like Jeremiah. And God says in verse 5, Jeremiah, if you have run with the footmen, and they have wearied thee. Jeremiah, if in the days of Josiah, a good king, you found it hard going to keep up, gird up your loins, Jeremiah, because now you're running against horses. You were running against men before, Jeremiah. Now you're against horses. You're up against the likes of Jehoiakim and Zedekiah and some wicked kings and some terrible prophets who will oppose you. Jeremiah, it's going to get worse. If in the land of peace, wherein thou trustest, they weary thee. In the days of Josiah, it was like running on flat and level ground. How are you going to go, Jeremiah, in the swelling of Jordan, down there in the undergrowth and the rough ground around the river Jordan, where the floods came up and left debris all around through the trees, where the lions and the snakes used to hide, said Jesus. You try running through there, Jeremiah. Keeping up with horses. And you might think that God sounds very unfeeling, but you see, sometimes the work has to be done. Courage has to be shown. Determination is needed. And in verse 6, he says to Jeremiah, "For even thy brethren and the house of thy father," it's not just hometown now, "his own family would turn on him." His own family would turn on him. It's quite remarkable. Look at those who were around Jeremiah. Some supported him. But he had three cousins who turned on him. And at various times in his life would become his fierce opponents. "Thine own family, Jeremiah, will turn upon thee. They have dealt treacherously with thee. They have called a multitude after thee. Believe them not, though they speak fair with thee." He couldn't trust his own relations anymore. Chapter 17 and verse 13. Look at this continual problem that he has with God. This is useful to us, brethren and sisters, because there are times in our lives when we really wonder what God's putting us through. What's the point of this? And why doesn't God fulfill his promises to be with us at all times? Jeremiah 17 and verse 13. "O Yahweh, the hope of Israel, all that forsake thee shall be ashamed, and they that depart from me shall be written in the earth, because they have forsaken Yahweh, the fountain of living waters." So to leave Yahweh was also to leave Jeremiah. "They that have forsaken thee shall depart from me." So even those of his supporters are now leaving him, forsaking the fountain of living waters. And he's always humble, as Jeremiah. Look at verse 14. "Heal me, O Yahweh, and I shall be healed. Save me, and I shall be saved, for thou art my praise." And then he gets back to his problem in verse 15. "Behold, they say unto me, where is the word of Yahweh?" You see, 23 years is going by. Nothing's happening. Lots of big words, Jeremiah. But the other prophets have been proved right. They said, "Peace, peace." And you're saying destruction. Jeremiah, they're right, and you're wrong. Where is the word of Yahweh, Jeremiah? And his credibility's gone down the drain. And he's saying, "Let it come now. God, let something come to pass." And then in verse 16, in his debate with God, he says, "Look, I didn't want this job. I have not hastened from being a shepherd to follow thee. Neither I desired the woeful day. Thou knowest that that which came out of my lips was right before thee. Be not a terror unto me." And in verse 18, "Let them be confounded that persecute me." And he's complaining again. He's reasoning with God. "Why, God, won't you do something to give me a sign that my words will come to pass?" Verse 19. "Jeremiah, go stand in the gate and say this." This time, Jeremiah, front up to the kings. And you might think there's an incredible lack of sympathy here, but you see, there's a work to be done. "I've made you an iron and brazen wall," says God, "against them. You've got to be courageous, Jeremiah." Chapter 18 and verse 18. "Then said they," this is Jeremiah's enemies, "come, let us devise devices against Jeremiah." Now the reason they wanted to do this was that Jeremiah's words were starting to hurt some of them. They said, "The law shall not perish from the priest, nor counsel from the wise." We have people who know what they're talking about. Jeremiah's an upstart. "Nor the word from the prophet." We love our false prophets. And then they say, "Come, let us smite him," as the margin correctly has, "for the tongue. And let us not give heed to any of his words." And then Jeremiah goes through that pain of gross ingratitude in verse 20. "Shall evil be recompensed for good? I stood to speak good for them, to turn away thy wrath from them." And in verse 23, "Yahweh, thou knowest their counsel against me." And I guess we might be saying to ourselves, well, it was only words. But we as human beings, we hate to be unpopular. We hate to be constantly criticised. We hate to be put down. We hate to be plotted against unjustly. And Jeremiah was suffering terribly. And then we come to chapter 20. Pasha the priest. Now, Pasha was in charge of the temple. He was responsible for what went on there. And because Jeremiah was now using the temple to make his prophecies, Pasha decided that the time was enough. If you read chapter 19 and verse 9, you see some of the words that Jeremiah is saying in the presence of the Jews near the temple. I will cause them to eat the flesh of their sons and the flesh of their daughters. They shall eat everyone the flesh of his friend in the siege and the straitness. And again is verse 12. I will do unto this place, saith Yahweh, and to the inhabitants thereof, and make this city as Tophet. That is like the local rubbish dump. And here's Jeremiah standing in their majestic city, in their great temple of Solomon. And he's saying words like that about what's going to come to this nation. And Pasha says, I've had enough. So we read in chapter 20 and verse 1. He was chief governor of the house of Yahweh. When he heard Jeremiah prophesied these things, he scourged Jeremiah. That's what the word should be, not smote. He didn't walk up and just tap him on the face. He had him scourged. And then he put him in the stocks. I mean, that sounds familiar, doesn't it? That's Acts 16. You might just make a note that in verse 13, he ends up singing to Yahweh. You see where Paul and Silas got it from? Scourged and put in the stocks. Well, they were like Jeremiah. They sang because of the persecutions they were going through. But look where he put him in the stocks, in the high gate of Benjamin. Now, the gate of Benjamin was where Jeremiah's hometown would come and go from Jerusalem. They only lived 5 miles north of Jerusalem. So everyone that Jeremiah knew would go through the gate of Benjamin. And he was put there to be put on, to make it a show of. Stocks are never comfortable. And when your back's been cut to ribbons by 39 stripes, it's a most uncomfortable place to be. And they would have spat on him and pelted him with fruit. And he was there for a day and night, verse 3. It came to pass on the morrow. So all of the rest of that day and all the next night, he was in the stocks. And then Pasha gets him out. Now, most men, having spent a scourging and 30-odd hours in the stocks, are very, very amenable. They will do anything not to be further punished. Not Jeremiah. What magnificent courage. Look what he says in verse 3. He fronts up to Pasha in an extremely courageous little speech that he got from God, obviously. And he says to him, Yahweh has not called thy name Pasha. Now, the name Pasha means one set free. A liberated man, if you like. Well, Pasha, that's not going to be true at all. Yahweh's changed your name, Pasha. He's going to call you Megor Misabib, which is quite correctly reported in the margin as fear round about. You think you're liberated, you're going to be in the bondage of fear, Pasha. And not just you, but your friends. Verse 6, thou, Pasha, and all that dwell in thine house shall go into captivity. Thou shalt come to Babylon and die there. And thou shalt be buried there. Thou and all thy friends to whom thou hast prophesied lies. You see, he was also a false prophet, was Pasha. He'd be one of those that was prophesying lies. And Jeremiah set his face like a flint, and he stood up to them that they would go to Babylon. He put them in their place. And it seems they were afraid to touch him. And they took his silence for fear. And so we find in verse 10 what they did. For I heard the defaming of many, says Jeremiah, fear on every side. You see, what they were doing was throwing back his words. And they began to provoke Jeremiah to say things that would get him further into trouble. It's exactly what happened with the scribes and Pharisees in Luke 11, verse 53, where it says they came to Jesus and began to urge him vehemently that he might speak of many things, that they might catch him in his words, that they might accuse him. And they are provoking Jeremiah, like happens in Luke 11, verse 53, to say something out of turn. And they're pushing him, and they're throwing back his words in his face. Come on, Jeremiah, let's have more of this fear on every side business. Come on, fear on every side, what does it mean? Say something else. Report. And the word should be denounce. Come on, Jeremiah, denounce us, and we'll denounce you. And they've watched for my halting, saying, peradventure he will be tricked. And we'll prevail against him. We'll make him say something that he'll be get caught for. Incredible, isn't it? That's the sort of treatment Jeremiah is getting from Pashur and his friends. And he stood up like a flint. But what they didn't see was the prophet falling apart inside. The wall looked solid. The wall looked like brass and iron. But inside Jeremiah, there was a tremendous fight going on. And he was crumbling. Now, you need to understand with Jeremiah 20 that the words that occur from verse 14 to verse 18 actually belong probably after verse 9, or probably after verse 8. They are put as an appendix on this chapter. That this chapter really ends with Jeremiah triumphing in verse 13, "Sing unto Yahweh, who will sort out the evildoers." But his thoughts that he went through in the lowest moment really belong after verse 8. But let's just go back to verse 7 and see what's happening inside the prophet's wall. Here's what he says, "O Yahweh, thou hast deceived me." Now, various Christadelphian commentators have tried to soften that because they say, well, he wouldn't be accusing God like that. He was accusing God of deception. He is resentful. He's saying to God, "This is far worse than you ever told me. You have deceived me," or persuaded me, "and I was deceived." They're not the same word, but it's you know, "You persuaded me. You tricked me into this, and I've been deceived. You're stronger than me, and you've prevailed. You've pushed me into this, God. I am in derision daily. Everyone mocks me." He repeats that in verse 8. "I am in derision daily. There was no respite from this." And we hate being mocked. You know, mocking is one of the cruelest things that people can do to us, is to mock us and make fun of us. And every day when it happens, it wears us down and we lose our self-respect. And then we have the words of verse 14 to verse 18. Let's just read those words very quickly. Now, if you've got an AV margin, you will notice that there's more than one cross-reference to Job chapter 3. Because these words are almost word for word from Job on the dunghill. And that's where Jeremiah's mind was. And that's exactly why James picks up the prophets and Job together. An example of suffering affliction of patience. Coming to grips with tremendous tragedy you can't understand in your life. And when things happen, they are never the things that we thought might happen. And when great tragedies strike and we just can't understand it, it's very human to start to question God and to wonder why we were ever born. And you read those words there that are taken from Job chapter 3. Jeremiah is saying, "It would have been far better if my mother had never born me." And that's exactly how Job felt. We can't understand any purpose for our life. And that belongs after verse 8. "The derision daily, his confidence is shattered. He can see no point for living." And then we come back to verse 9. "Then I said, I will not make mention of him." I've had it, God. I'm resigning. I'm sorry. I'm not going to say one more word. This job is over. But I couldn't do it. The word was like a fire inside my bones. I was weary with forbearing and I had to speak. The word burnt as a fire. You know, once you know the truth, brethren and sisters, it's very, very hard to walk away and to say you will speak no more in his name. I know many people who have left the truth and gone out of the ecclesial circles who go on preaching because the word's still a fire in their bones. Jeremiah couldn't leave it. So he had to work back to confidence. Look at verse 11. "But Yahweh is with me as a terrible mighty one." You see, he starts to recount the promises of God. God had said, "I am with you, Jeremiah." Twice he said that in chapter 1. "I will deliver you. Therefore my persecutors shall stumble. They shall not prevail. They shall be greatly ashamed. They shall not prosper." And he's trying to convince himself by saying, "It will come to pass that I'll be vindicated." And this great struggle with God. Verse 12. "But O Yahweh of hosts, I've just accused you of deception. I'm sorry, I know that's not right, but I just don't know how to explain it. You try the righteous. I know this is part of the trial. And you seest the reins in the heart. Let me see the day when thy vengeance falls on them. For unto thee I've opened my cause. And you see, there's the way that he got back to spirituality. There are many times in life and we just can't understand what God's doing. We can't see any possible good in a situation. But we have to do that. We have to open to God our cause. And to believe that he is righteous, and that he knows best, and that he will bring the day to pass in his own good time. And we end up in verse 13, singing unto Yahweh, praising Yahweh, for he hath delivered the soul of the poor from the hand of evildoers. And there was confidence that Jeremiah had. He went through that terrible time of depression. And so it went on, brothers and sisters, for many years. I want you to now come to chapter 32. Jeremiah went through several phases of that struggle. Because of what he had learned, he was later able to help Baruch, the son of Neriah, go through the same problem of depression. But James said, remember the end of the Lord. And we come to Jeremiah 32. Now, it's very important to realise that the chapters that we call the restoration prophecies, that is 30 to 33, should be read in the order 32, 33, 30, 31. And you can prove that when you check the context and the time they were written. We're actually given the dating of those prophecies. It should be read 32, 33, 30, 31. 32, the Jews will return from captivity. 33, there will be a restoration of the throne of David. Chapter 30, there will be a restoration in the latter days. And chapter 31, there will be the great second exodus and the children of Israel will come back to live in their own land forever. So these chapters have a glorious theme. And it's very interesting to read them in that order. But we want to focus upon a little incident in chapter 32 and verse 6. Jeremiah was put in the prison in the latter part of his life. He went through two terrible imprisonments, one in the house of Jonathan, one in the pit down under the king's house. But in between times, he was kept in the court of the prison. You see, he was too much of a security risk to be out in the city talking to the people. And so they locked him up in the court of the prison. And it was there in verse 6 that Yahweh had said, verse 7, behold, Hanamel, the son of Shallum, thine uncle shall come unto thee, saying, buy my field that's in Anathoth, for the right of redemption is thine to buy it. Now, we need to just remember that at the time this prophecy was taking place, the whole land except the city of Jerusalem was under the control of the Babylonians. The men of Anathoth had been wiped out. And Uncle Hanamel reckons that his property in Anathoth is not a great investment at this particular time. And he comes to Jeremiah and says, I've got to sell the property. And you have first right to buy it. Because you're the only one left of Anathoth. Now, it's not a great time to be buying a block of land when the Babylonians are camped on it. And God says to Jeremiah, you buy it. When he comes, you say, buy it. And so the uncle Hanamel comes in just as God said. Rips him off 17 shekels of silver for a block of land that the Babylonians are sitting on. But I want you to notice, if you've got a coloured pencil there, or any sort of pencil, if you've got a coloured pencil, just go from verse 10 and just colour in these words. So there was a transaction, there was a sale of land that took place. And God says in verse 10, I subscribe the evidence. Colour in the word evidence and the word witnesses. Sealed it and took witnesses. Verse 11, I took the evidence of the purchase. Verse 12, I gave the evidence unto Barak. Halfway through verse 12, the presence of the witnesses. Verse 14, take these evidences, this evidence. I sealed this evidence. Verse 16, I had delivered the evidence. Verse 25, take witnesses. Verse 44, evidences, witnesses. I might have missed one or two there, but you can check them out. Now, that tells you something. If I said to you, what two chapters in the Bible remind you of the word evidence and witnesses, what two adjoining chapters would you think of? Hebrews 11. Faith is the evidence of things not seen. And Hebrews 12, we are encompassed about with a cloud of witnesses. See, there's your evidence and witnesses, isn't it? So what we have here is evidence and witnesses. Faith is the evidence of things not seen. And we are encompassed with witnesses. Now the lesson of why Jeremiah was to buy a field that was currently in captivity, when he asked, what's this all about? Why have I bought a block of land that I'll never ever see because we're all going into captivity? God says in verse 15, the reason, Jeremiah, that I want you to buy that block of land is a testimony of one fact. Verse 15, houses and fields and vineyards shall be possessed again in this land. Right. So he does what he's told. Now you know what he was told to do? He was told to take the evidences, that is the title deeds and the purchase documents and the list of those that witnessed the transaction, and to put it in, as it says in verse 14, you take the evidences and the list of witnesses and put them in an earthen vessel that they might continue many days. Now we know that documents can continue many days in earthen vessels. The Dead Sea Scrolls are nearly as old as these documents of Jeremiah. And they are still legible today because they were stored in earthen vessels. We have this treasure in earthen vessels, says God, that after many days, the documents will be useful. And they were buried by Barak somewhere in the city of Jerusalem. Because it says in verse 16, he gave it to Barak, the son of Neriah, to go and bury it as required. And he was to learn, as verse 17 says, the end of verse 17, there is nothing too hard for God. I've just bought a block of land that the Babylonians own at the moment. But it's an evidence of my faith that nothing is too hard for God. Verse 27 says the same thing. Is anything too hard for me, says God? Jeremiah, don't doubt the fact that I can give you your block of land. Nothing is too hard for God. Brethren and sisters, our God is a wonderful, merciful, and extremely just God who believes in poetic justice. You've only got to read the Bible to see how poetic God's justice and mercy is. And what God had done for Jeremiah is to secure his inheritance. When you go through the Bible, you find a remarkable list of men that have been promised a part of the land. In the day when the righteous inherit the land and dwell therein forever, there are men in the Bible who have been promised a particular section of that land as their personal inheritance. Where else would Abraham live but Hebron? Fellowship. That's where Abraham will be. Isaac, Beersheba, the well of the oath. Jacob, Bethel, the house of God, the 40-year cycle of his life from Bethel to Bethel. We're absolutely sure where Joseph's going to live. I have given you the one portion, the inheritance of Joseph is at Shechem. Joshua, they buried him in his inheritance at Timnath-Serah. You know what Timnath-Serah means? A place under the sun. Samson, they buried him in his inheritance in Zorah. His family, the Danites, had left their inheritance and gone up to the north. But in the end, Samson, the great victor, comes back to his own inheritance, and they buried him there. David, obviously, Bethlehem. Jeremiah will have Anathoth. And the deeds, the city of Anathoth. And perhaps by this stage, Hanamel, who was hiding in Jerusalem, owned most of Anathoth. We don't know how much it was. But it's been given to Jeremiah forever. And you can go right through about the inheritance of different people in the Bible. In a day not too soon distant, brethren and sisters, after the earthquake, when the land is restored to its beauty, when the temple is being built, the Lord Jesus Christ will take Jeremiah somewhere near Jerusalem and say to Jeremiah, "Jeremiah, just dig under that pile of rubble. And there will be the title deeds to his inheritance. And he will live just 5 miles from the house of prayer for all nations." And the prophecy flowed on to show Jeremiah that God would bring his people back to their land, that God would restore the fortunes of Israel, and that God's covenant with David and Abraham would never be broken. And when we come back to chapter 31, he awakes from his dream. He awakes from the vision he's just had. Now remember, this is after chapter 32. And he says in verse 24, "There shall dwell in Judah." You see, that was the promise. "There shall yet dwell in this place flocks and herds. There shall yet dwell in Judah, and in the cities thereof together, husbandmen that go forth with flocks." And God says, "For I have satiated, Jeremiah, every weary soul. I have replenished every sorrowful soul, Jeremiah. I know it's hard in this life, Jeremiah. I know it's been a long time. But Jeremiah, the end is near for you, but the inheritance is sure, Jeremiah. It's secure there. You will own Anathoth in the kingdom." And then he says in verse 26, "Upon this I await, and behold, my sleep was sweet unto me. Weeping may endure for a night, but joy cometh in the morning." And Jeremiah will look back upon his night of sorrows. He will look back upon the time of darkness, and it will seem sweet unto him because of the reward that it will bring him in the kingdom of God. Brethren and sisters, let us learn from the prophet Jeremiah. No matter what the trial, no matter how hard to understand the things that God allows to happen, no matter how hard, brethren and sisters, think of Jeremiah. Think of the 23 years of nothing coming to pass, of all the daily derision and mocking that he received, of the scourging, the imprisonments, the loss of friends, the loss of Josiah. And remember to plead our cause unto Yahweh and to sing unto his praises, because we are confident that he will redeem us from the power of the grave. Brethren and sisters, when we awake, our night will seem sweet unto us.